we better get started. I commend you on getting through snow and sleet and all sorts of things to get to Newmarket. And thank you very much for coming. For those of you who I haven't managed to meet so far, I'm Chris Garibaldi. I'm the director of the National Horse Racing Museum. And it's a real pleasure to invite you here to Newmarket to look at the whole genre of British sporting art, particularly in the context of our redevelopment. And my introduction is going to be a fairly informal one, looking at the broad historical context of Newmarket, so that British sporting art can be seen in that framework, and particularly bedding down what our plans for this site are within the general history of British horse racing and sporting art in general. So, without further ado, Wenda, we have the lights, that would be brilliant. I'll just talk to you a little bit about the context for the National Horse Racing Museum. We occupy our present site on Newmarket's High Street, seen on the left-hand side, next to the Jockey Club rooms, and have been on that site for the last 32 years. In a space called the subscription rooms, which were in effect the sort of next rank down from the Jockey Club rooms proper that you'll see this evening if you stay for a drink with us. The Jockey Club rooms were remodeled at various stages, most recently the facade in the 1930s, but are based around a coffee house that was acquired from around 1751 as a centre for gatherings of those following the races in Newmarket. Originally open to everyone, used by both members of the Jockey Club and a wider public, until the mid-1770s, when someone had the audacity to accuse a member of the club of cheating at cards. And so it was then very much turned into a private members' club. And in a sense, it was the aristocratic owners on one side in the Jockey Club room proper, and the next social sort of pecking order down in terms of the subscription rooms of trainers and upper tradesmen of the town. And the subscription rooms survived right the way through until 1981, somewhat unbelievably, I think. At that point, they weren't really being used by a full membership, and a real head of steam had built up to create a national museum of horse racing. And so they closed the subscription rooms in 1981 and reopened, formally by the Queen, who is our patron, in 1983. And I'm delighted that one of the people sitting in this room, Pat Connor, who has joined us, was hugely involved in the first display work that created the museum 32 years ago. So it's wonderful to have that connection with the museum's earliest history. But we have, through gift and bequest and acquisition, over 30 years, acquired a huge and significant collection, and we're bursting at the seams on the present site. And I think the present museum would have redeveloped 10, 15 years ago, but for the fact that the Palace House site came onto the horizon. And this crucially gives us 5 acres right in the heart of the town, which will allow us in the new museum to accommodate live horses as part of the visitor experience. But I just wanted to share sort of the thumbnail sketch of the historic context to Newmarket. First really established as a centre for royal patronage under James I, who first came here in 1604, travelling between a hunting lodge in Royston and in Thurston, effectively gets stuck in the fog and wakes up, having put up at the Griffin Inn in Newmarket's High Street, to realise that the Newmarket Heath represents the most fantastic opportunity for hunting and hawking and hare coursing, predominantly, and stag hunting as well. Now, the image I always use to sort of illustrate that for people is the wonderful image of the Fitzwilliam collection of stag hunting in front of Nonsuch Palace. I'm not in any way trying to say that the palace that was built in Newmarket was in any way as elaborate as Nonsuch, but this is, of course, the sort of courtly social milieu one has to think of in terms of the court regularly coming up here from 1604 on. But James I does build his own palace. It's first a rather rudimentary edifice, And in 1613, there's a rather wonderful story of it falling down. It appears that it had a fair degree of subsidence. There's a rather dramatic account of part of the building collapsing, bursting the windows bursting out from it because of the pressure of the lintels. I suspect there's something rather exaggerated in the telling, and because it's always told that James I was sort of pulled out in the middle of the night and life was saved when the edifice collapsed around him. But it was certainly a fairly shoddy building. So from 1613 through to the early 1620s, a huge amount of money was poured into that first palace in Newmarket. At least £20,000, which was an extraordinary amount at the time. And one of the extraordinary features of the first palace in Newmarket was the prince's lodgings designed by Inigo Jones. And this is the first design. Both designs are in the British galleries of V&A, in the Reba collection. This is the first schematic design for the prince's lodgings, based on Palladio's Villa Scamozzi, with the number 30 in Burlington's own hand, the other Burlington up on the right-hand side. What we think is this was a kind of first stab at what the lodgings might look like, and obviously a very pure Palladian scheme, and this is more close to what was actually built, because it's a measured drawing. You can see the measurements up on the left-hand side. Even then, when you look in detail at the king's works, it's likely that the actual edifice that was put up was a somewhat simpler construct to this. It was to some extent an aspirational design, but it is nevertheless extraordinary to think that sitting on Newmarket's High Street was a building of this importance by Inigo Jones. Evidence for its attribution to Newmarket is very solid. Work done by John Harris and some 20-30 years ago. Apart from anything else, these are a series of architectural details by John Webb, assistant to Inigo Jones, that have survived in the collections of Worcester College in Oxford. And they have a window frame that equates to that found on the design, specifically said to be a window frame at the Palace of Newmarket. Other architectural details are extant elements from other royal palaces, but most crucially, this element of cornice is described as being interrupted on one facade with a window opening, but being entire on the other face. And hopefully, no, I'm gonna go back. And it is in fact absolutely that cornice there. So we're looking at one of those window openings here, and then the cornice detail on the other side as you turn the corner. So it's a very important loss to British architecture that this edifice was pulled down in the 1650s. The very fact that it is shown so regularly in the British galleries and the V&A, it is basically the archetype of every English country house design from the restoration on, so from the 1660s, and here it was in Newmarket. This is another design in the V&A collections which is more loosely attributed to the palace at Newmarket, and it's not known who it's by, but on for a number of reasons, it's thought that this could have been the ceiling of the central room of the prince's lodgings. And just to give you an idea of what the palace would have looked like, this is the surviving element of the hunting lodge at Royston of James I. And this is the back of Moon's toy shop in the High Street, which we believe is part of that original King's lodgings further back on the site. And so really what I'm trying to say is that we should think of the palace in terms of the very famous image of Whitehall, where you've got a stand-out element of the Jonesian banqueting house surrounded by some very modest vernacular buildings, and that's what the palace in that sort of amalgam of edifices would have looked like sitting on a large site stretching back from the High Street. And so it's, if you look at this Chapman map of Newmarket from the late 1780s, it's described here as being the old King's Yard, that that area there. Interestingly, there are a number of other designs in the suite labelled in Burlington's hand sequentially. So the design for the Prince's Lodgings, which we know to be Newmarket, is number 30. We've got 27, 28, 29 that are other edifices which may relate to some of the brew houses of the original palace, or they may simply be aspirational designs that have no direct connection with the site. We just don't know. But they haven't been cited anywhere else. That palace, though, was pulled down in the 1650s as a calculated political act. Under Cromwell, it's the usual sort of mythology. He didn't like racing, sort of Puritan, all sorts of usual nonsense Cromwell banned Christmas. Absolutely not. Race meetings were identified as being potential excuses for royalists to muster and kick off rebellion. If you think of the average race meeting in the 17th century, both participants and spectators are on horseback. So a race meeting looks like just a rabble of mounted figures in the countryside. It was thought with some justification that royalists were using race meetings as an excuse to muster, and so it's just to suppress that, racing was banned. And this is one of, I think it's three surviving examples, very rare example, of one of the proclamations issued in 1658, suppressing racing in England and Wales, prohibiting horse races, rather interestingly, issued by Cromwell as Lord Protector by this point, and it talks about being a proclamation of His Highness. And it keeps talking about His Highness's Palace of Westminster. I think it's a rather wonderful insight in the language it uses of the reality of rule under the Protectorate, rather than a parliamentary rule at the beginning of the interregnum. So the only word it doesn't have is His Royal Highness's territories. But this was published in 1658. The original palace had been sold by that point to a consortium of parliamentarians, and it was effectively pulled down, used as building materials, but I think very much trying to suppress the whole culture of racing within Newmarket. So when Wren is sent up in the 1660s as newly appointed surveyor, he describes it as being nothing more than a vacant yard. And the decision is then taken to move the palace up to this site. And this is what we have surviving in Palace House across the car park. It's the last element of that palace, put up between 1668 and 1671, ultimately under the responsibility of Wren, but actually designed by the gentleman architect William Samwell. And most of the palace was then pulled down in the mid 19th century, from 1855 on, when the site was finally sold off by Queen Victoria, who was taking no interest at that point in racing and almost trying to put clear blue water between herself and the wicked uncles, and self-consciously doesn't follow racing. The palace has got into a poor state of repair, and most of it is then pulled down in the 1860s. Fortunately for us, this pavilion, which is the King's lodgings, was purchased in 1857 by the Rothschild family and became their racing base in Newmarket, which is how it has survived. And interestingly, one of the things we've always wondered is why there is no design for the palace. And then when we had an exhibition a couple of years ago and borrowed the designs from the drawings by Webb from Worcester College, we'd always known that this edifice here is labelled as the Clerk of Works House in Newmarket at the palace. And then as the drawings came out of the crate, I looked down and realised that at the bottom of the sheet is a sketch, which I think is Webb working out a design for the palace facade. It absolutely equates exactly with the King's Lodgings, the doorway completely, with the string course, and then a cornice. And if you see the change in brick colour of the edifice,
The second story was originally a garret room attic that was only established as a full second floor under the Rothschilds in 1860. So we have, I think, the original sketch designed for the edifice in those web drawings at Worcester College. And this is what the whole palace would have looked like, with courtesy of country life and with a nod to Simon Thurley, who put this together. What survived in the top corner is the King's Lodgings, i.e. Palace House. So the run of state apartments, the Queen's Lodgings that face the High Street, the front lodgings of the Duke of York, and then the offices, and ultimately the Royal Confectionery, which stood on this site, have all been lost. And this shows the importance of the palace within its landscape context. It's wooden from... 1718, and shows George I in the bottom right-hand corner attending the races in Newmarket, and really starts to show the extent of these race meetings. And in the centre is a depiction of the palace as originally built. We'll come back to that. One of the extraordinary things we have is the survival from 1783 of a complete inventory of the palace contents. It's in the record office at Bury St Edmunds. It goes room by room, sticker furniture by sticker furniture. And what is interesting is it keeps making the point that these are old pieces. It also names the tapestries that we have hanging here, and it was the Dido and Aeneas suite down now at Hampton Court, or one of the versions, and the Diogenes tapestries, which we know a very important Mortlake set that were transferred originally to the Victoria and Albert Museum in South Kensington and then transferred up to Holyrood, and they currently hang in the King's Closet at the Palace of Holyrood in Edinburgh. So it gives something, a really rather evocative image of what the small King's Closet rooms and other royal accommodation would have looked like in Palace House as originally built, albeit with not such fine ceilings. But it is extraordinary, the inventory. It's a rare, very, very important survival. And I think in constantly talking about old furniture, it's in effect giving us the clue to the furnishings as supplied in 1705 when the palace was comprehensively remodelled for Queen Anne, the great follower of English racing. Prince George of Denmark, very, very committed follower of the turf. And we've got a wonderful loan that has come into the museum in preparation for the Palace House hang of a wooden of Prince George of Denmark's horse Leeds. So we're starting to acquire images now that really support and underline the history of the building, as well as sort of more general sporting art images. So that gives you an idea of Palace House as it sits. That is the surviving element of the whole of the rest of the palace pulled down in the 1860s. Just going up, going up close into the wooden image, you see the palace on the right-hand side. Hopefully, the light's a bit poor here, but you see on the left-hand side. And the point is that Samwell was the architect responsible for the garden wing at Felbrigg in Norfolk. And so we have a very good idea of what the palace would have looked like with his garret rooms. Samwell worked at Felbrigg, moves down to Newmarket, and then goes on to work at Ham House in London. And it's at Ham that you also find these counter-weighted sash windows, one of which was discovered with between two layers of wall within the palace when it was restored in 1994. But rather satisfying for us, the Ham examples are 2 or 3 years later. So we have in the building the earliest extant counterweighted sash window anywhere in the country. Thank you very much. So if you come for nothing else, that's what you should do. You know, it makes the architect and historian salivate. The other crucial thing that we know from the Thomas Fort survey from the early 18th century is that right opposite the palace, and this may be the reason why the palace was ultimately moved up here under Charles II, was the existence of the great stables, which this is the ground plan. The importance of those were that we didn't know whether anything had survived. When the site is sold off by Queen Victoria in 1855, these are described as being beyond repair, and they're pulled down, albeit that the materials are reused to build the Victorian boxes on the far side of the site across the road. So we can see the materials, but they've been reused. The assumption was that the block had been levelled, but in fact, our archaeological investigation, and we got Time Team up, and Baldrick came and did his stuff and stood in a trench, we've discovered that all the footings are under the King's Courtyard, where the central area of the museum will be. But more than that, we discovered that the stable range, the front had been pulled down, but the trainer's house that was built under the Rothschilds in the 1850s was built into the back wall of the stables. So this wall sits in the centre of the trainer's house. Because the trainer's house was comprehensively arsoned in the 1980s, the last trainer to train out of there, Bruce Hobbs, retired, failed to find an owner. 88, absolute classic thing happened. People went in, nicked the fireplaces, and then torched it out of boredom, completely burnt out. We were able to take a much more archaeological approach than we would have otherwise been allowed to take, and we found a large segment of this original 1670s wall sitting in the centre of the building, and that will form the backdrop to the collections that we show in the National Horse Racing Museum, which will be on that side of the site. Given the evidence that we have from the web drawings that Palace House was a reworking of elements that had survived the 1650 demolition of the first palace, it could even be that this relates to the original great stables of Inigo Jones, put up in the 1620s. I'm always being told and warned I mustn't find what I want to find in these things, but there's a very, very important job to do in unpicking what we're actually looking at that wall that we've discovered. Now, I've just been given the signal that I'm running over, so I'm going to flash through some of these images, just to say that the palace stopped being used regularly after 1791 and the Great Escape Scandal, which is George IV, Prince of Wales, big racing operation in Newmarket, is accused of cheating in a race. Sam Chifney, his a jockey, is accused of pulling in a race. He did very badly in one heat and then very well in a subsequent heat. And an official investigation was launched, and the jockey club, by that point having the regulatory function of the sport, to their credit, Prince of Wales or no Prince of Wales, found against him. He was reprimanded, and as a result, in high dudgeon, as Princes of Wales sometimes do when told that they've done the wrong thing, he stomped off, said he was never going to darken Newmarket's doors again, and effectively sold his racing interests there. But this contemporary cartoon shows Chifney with his whip between his teeth, obviously pulling the race, and the horse is tethered by the garter, saying, "On Iswaki Malipons," how to escape winning at Newmarket, which is rather fun. And it always says, everyone says it looks like he's on a mobile phone, he's tipping his nose, and sort of, something's gone awry. So I'm just going to whiz through the later history of the site. This is an aerial photograph taken very early stage in the 1920s, flying over the 4-acre paddock that sits at the back of the site and is what allows us to have live horses in the future. These are some photographs from the late 1870s. And somewhat later, showing the King's Yard in its original form as a 19th century training yard. And this is Alfred Hayhoe, one of the trainers that trained out of Palace House. In 1903, Leopold Rothschild built a second stable yard onto the site, and that allows us to have, we're restoring that fully to accommodate the live horses we're going to have. And then I really am going to rush through. It all got into a pretty poor state of repair. This is Palace House in the early 1990s. It had got into the hands of an unscrupulous property developer who had illegally concrete rendered it, and that had to be dealt with in the restoration. So sometimes people criticise Palace House for looking a little bit wire brush, but you've got to remember about an inch and a half of pure raw concrete had to be chiselled off it to get back to the core that sat in the centre. And I think they did a very, very good job to get the essential core of the King's Pavilion re-established. So, National Horse Racing Museum, you know, we currently work with the British Sporting Art Trust, we're going to be joined by the Retraining of Racehorses charity, and really, at lunchtime, we
We're going to split into two groups. I'm going to take half the group out and just, we can't do a full site tour, but we can see some of the elements of the new buildings. And then we'll have a film that shows the form of the new buildings that are going to make up the new National Heritage Centre for Horse Racing and Sporting Art at Palace House Newmarket, Fine Art of British Sporting Art in the Palace, National Horse Racing Museum, all singing, all dancing, on the other side of the house, of the site, and then 4 acres of paddock for the public to encounter that glory of racing, which is the English thoroughbred. Thank you. It's all there.
Thank you all very much for coming today. Our first session is entitled Traditional Definitions of Sporting Art. I have to say, this is a bit of a luxury for us, because we're in the middle of working on the displays that will go into Palace House. So we're hoping that some of the questions that come up today will help feed into how we interpret the pictures we're going to put on display. And I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Nicholas Price, who's an independent art dealer and a long-standing member of the British Sporting Art Trust. And he's going to be speaking about British sporting art and its place in the commercial art world.